Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols. You'll meet Tanis Morgan in this episode. Tanis is the Director of the Centre for Teaching, Learning and Innovation at the Justice Institute of British Columbia. And as you'll hear, she's doing some wonderful work there. Tanis and I talked via Skype with Tanis in Vancouver. Tanis is an Open Education Award winner whose practice is based on a distance education heritage, which adds an interesting flavour and perspective to her work. Okay, well, I'm talking now with Dr. Tanis Morgan, who is Director of the Centre for Teaching, Learning and Innovation at the Justice Institute of British Columbia. Tanis, it's great to have you as a legend of online learning.
Well, thank you. It's really great to be here.
Great. So you're talking, I think, from Vancouver now, are you, over Skype?
Yes, I am, yeah.
Brilliant, thanks. So you won the BC Campus Award for Excellence in Open Education this year. So you're clearly a legend of online learning. It's a pleasure to be talking with you.
Tanis, well, thank you, yeah.
So, Tanis, can you begin by just giving us a brief overview of your career and innovative work to date?
I started in distance education at the for distance education technology. It was a center at the University of British Columbia. And at the time, Tony Bates was the director, and he retired shortly after I began, and Mark Boland took his place. But this was a really fantastic place to begin working in distance education, because we were a center that was a very large center with a long history, and there was a lot of care and attention that really went into, I guess, working with distance education students across the province. And of course, with Tony Bates there, there was also this open university background sort of lens that could be brought to the center and to our activities as well. And I think that really did inform a lot of what we did. So for me, this was a bit of a dream job. I really enjoyed that experience, and as a result, distance education really informs a lot of the work that I do in open now. I really come at it with that lens.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So your introduction to online learning then was from a distance education standpoint?
Completely, actually, yes. And even before I began at DET, I was actually working in the area of self-directed learning for language learners. So I really actually came at it from educational technology was always part of what I was doing, but certainly the farther back I went, it had less of an importance. So really going back to that pure sort of self-directed learning via whatever means possible kind of approach to thinking about access in higher education.
Fantastic. Tanis, what can you tell us about your BC Campus Award for Excellence?
Well, so BC Campus is doing this wonderful initiative where they highlight a person a month for this year. And so I'm among other wonderful recipients. And basically, they're highlighting a variety of different people working in open education with specifically OERs in the province. And so my institution, the Justice Institute of BC, is part of three institutions who are funded through BC Campus to create what we call a ZCred, which is a zero-cost textbook program. We've been doing that for quite a long time, and the work that I've been doing at the Justice Institute really goes back quite far in terms of open education resources. So I think it was just a really nice extension and recognition of some of the work we're doing at the JIBC.
Brilliant. So, Tanis, you've obviously taken some ideas and themes across into your work. Can you tell us a little bit about those ideas and themes that your work is based on and that you sense might be of relevance to others?
First of all, I have to say that any sort of success that we've had in open, I mean, there really is a really big we behind it. So, the culture of the institution, the team that I have to work with me, I mean, that's really where a big part of the success comes from. But I think what's really worked well in approaching this field of open as it is now, because it does seem to have evolved, and I feel like people come at it from a variety of different routes, and as a result, it's being informed by different things, which is really great. But it's also important to sort of recognize that the open movement, as it is, for lack of a better word, is informed by many perspectives. There is no one sort of thing. So it's I think really with that angle for us at the JI, open is really, it really is about access. We work with students who are, for the most part, adult learners. They come from a variety of different backgrounds. They're very busy people. Some of them are what you would call non-traditional. And some of the things we've been able to do has really been about attracting people to the institution who maybe never thought it was possible to be part of formal higher education as well. So I think I'm most proud of that element of what we're doing. But certainly what we're doing is, it's so multi-pronged. It's not just an open textbook program. We do so much of a variety of things in the area of open because it's very case by case. It's not possible for us to actually just be a blanket open. It really is a case by case situation. And what I've come to realize more recently in the open movement is that's okay. I feel like in the beginning, there was a lot of push to be all open all day for everything. And I think now there's a much greater recognition that it's, in some cases, it's not always possible or desirable.
So what sort of frameworks do you apply to keep things open? I mean, you mentioned that there are some limits. What are some of those limits?
Some of the limits for us, because we work in the areas of justice and public safety, is really actually around security and information that has to be kept private that isn't available for the public because of security or safety requirements. So, for example, you know, in training police officers, there are certain techniques that they use that really can't be public because otherwise criminals would take advantage of that knowledge. So it's, you know, it's as mundane as that, quite honestly. And certainly, yeah, we're navigating a variety of different content and subject matter, and some of it is incredibly difficult subject matter as well. Some of that really, you know, you wouldn't really want to put in front of people unless they were well-trained to handle it.
Right. So you are working with the Justice Institute. So I'd imagine many of your students may well be police officers or actively involved in that part of British Columbia's public service.
Yes, exactly. I mean, we work with police, fire, and paramedics, but we also work with a lot of community-based programs. So, you know, social workers and victim services and that sort of thing. So we have a lot of very highly focused niche content areas and niche program areas that you wouldn't find at, you know, every single institution or university or college or whatever it might be, because it really only resides at the JIBC because of its mandate.
Great. So, Tanis, it's now coming up to mid-2018. I'm really interested to have your observations about online learning and education at the present time. What sort of things are going on out there? What sort of themes are you noticing?
Well, I've been working so much in open lately and less in just the generic sort of online space. So certainly, I guess what I'm noticing in our conversations about open, which obviously extends to online, is a greater desire to be critical of our approaches and to be maybe I feel like we're reaching a new stage of maturity in how we talk about open and how we talk about online. We're a little bit more critical of the systems and platforms that we use, a little more critical about the public versus private, a little more critical as well about, you know, the role of public institutions in a space that's often occupied by commercial providers. So I feel like that represents a certain kind of maturity, which I think is really quite welcome. One thing I guess that I'm noticing, because in the last year I've been digging into, I guess, the history of how we talked about innovation in higher education in the 1960s and 70s, and how we talked about open in the 1960s and 70s, and things like self-directed learning and that sort of thing. And I've become quite interested in just how similar and different those conversations were. And I guess I can say that I feel like there's a lot of similarities, but in some ways we seem to have lost so many lessons learned, and that's quite interesting to me. And I feel as well that maybe some of our activities are so focused at a more granular course type of level, and innovation doesn't seem to be happening at a program or institutional level like it was in the 60s and the 70s, when there were these larger higher education reforms that were, and social reforms that were having a real impact on higher education.
Tell us more about that. That's quite an interesting theme to pick on, that the fact that we're both getting but also leaving behind some important lessons from the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of us, I think, in the open education world who are looking into this from different angles, and Martin Weller, certainly, with his team with Katie Jordan and Erwin DeVries, are doing that in the UK, and Vivian Rolfe as well worked with me more recently on a presentation about this. But I guess my own personal conclusion about what I've seen around the themes of innovation, open pedagogy, is that we're a lot less ambitious with our goals with what we do now. Whereas, you know, the open universities, for example, emerged in a context that, I mean, first of all, I think an open university is an amazing innovation in itself for higher education. And, you know, when you compare that to the mania of MOOCs, and you compare what a MOOC does versus what an open university does, I just find that one is so much more ambitious and has a greater impact on, you know, the social environment than the other. And I find it interesting that that's all been lost. I also find it interesting that, you know, in the MOOC sort of creation, there was all of a sudden a gold rush of trying to develop MOOC platforms, when actually I'm still not convinced that we needed MOOC platforms. That wasn't really what we needed. We needed perhaps to think about ways for higher education to offer valuable credits to this type of activity that would actually be meaningful to people who, you know, were going to be impacted by them.
So I suppose the challenge is still there for open universities to remain open and open themselves up still further.
I think probably there is. I mean, I've never actually had the opportunity to work in an open university, but certainly the spaces that I work in higher education, I'm very much interested in looking at, I guess, breaking apart from the course paradigm that we seem to be in, and looking more at, you know, who's not coming to higher education, and why is that? And if we did something differently, would they come? And, you know, what are the real barriers to them accessing higher education? And I really feel like open really provides an opportunity to address a lot of that. But it's not just one thing. It's a combination of things, I think, that higher education has to think about and, you know, evolve towards. So I think that's the point that we're at. And just keeping the same sort of paradigms isn't necessarily going to get everybody either.
And interesting, Tanis, that you've used the terms open and online fairly similarly, as if they're almost synonyms. Do you think open education now should be online, or that there's a very strong direction pointed towards online? Do we run the risk of leaving some learners behind?
Yes, absolutely. I think so. But I mean, I'm working in the context of Canada, where for the most part, online is feasible. However, I think we have to be critical of that too. What do you lose when you go online? And you know, what does everything need to be online? I think there's a lot of interesting discussion that could happen about, you know, supportive learning spaces that aren't online, for example. But again, that's kind of going back to perhaps the old open university model of having various contact centers throughout in, you know, rural and remote regions that brought people together in a supportive way. But I mean, I'm not suggesting that we need to go backwards completely, but, you know, I feel like there was a point in time where we sort of threw away a lot of the good things about open education for learning management systems and for, you know, a new model of distance education that went online, but kind of left behind some of the flexibility and support that went with the old model. So I think that's something that deserves, I guess, greater attention perhaps.
It leads us on to another question, actually. What research would you most like to see at the moment? If you were to open up a journal or a magazine and find the perfect article that sort of hit you where you're at the moment, what would that article be?
Oh, geez. My interests just seem to jump around, but I'm very interested, for example, in these history conversations. And I did actually recently come across a journal that was actually in a journal from Spain, and it was an open journal. And in every single issue, they actually highlight a historical article, or they have a, you know, a lecture that was given in some point in time in history. And it's an education journal. And I thought that's a really nice addition to a journal, to have that historical component that's front and center in every issue. So I think that's an interesting idea. The other thing I guess I'd like to see more attention to is that our focus has been mostly on the products of English-speaking journals, and I don't feel like there's enough attention paid to journals that are being produced in other languages and other parts of the world. And if there's a way to surface those somehow and bring those to the attention of readers who mainly just focus on English language journals. I think we're probably missing something there as well.
Great. So you think there's a great deal of international research that is yet to really make it into the English-speaking world?
I feel like there probably is, and certainly that seems to be something that is a more recent conversation as well. If I look at what went on at OpenCon in Berlin last year, it feels like that was a theme. And certainly I've been working more recently in Mexico and also focusing my attention on other parts of the world. And I feel like, there is a lot out there that doesn't really get surfaced. And, it'd be nice if there was a way to, break down those barriers a little bit too and turn our attention to what's happening that may not be in English.
Brilliant. Tanis, it's really impressive. Just your thoughts of reaching back into history for the lessons that are already there. I'm really impressed too by the distance education background and how you've been able to bring that to bear on your online and open practice. And I think to the international perspective you're suggesting is really quite overdue actually in online learning.
I don't think I'm alone in thinking that, and certainly the work of the ROER4D group in South Africa is, I've been paying a lot of attention to that. So certainly there's people who are leading that, and I think it's been an important piece of the puzzle to actually grasp onto and think about in terms of where our interests might go next.
So Tanis, it leads us on quite nicely to the last question. So two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective has really influenced you, and one who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share.
Yeah, I had a really hard time thinking about this, honestly, because when I think of legends, I certainly don't include myself in that mix. And I think of the distance education pioneers, and that includes Tony Bates and Alan Tate and those open university people that I think are quite, well associated with that. Mm. And for the most part, male, as it turns out as well. But so I would really, for the purposes of describing legends, it's really, really difficult. And I would like to recommend somebody who maybe is female and not white and maybe I could point to in terms of, doing some great things in distance education in a jurisdiction that isn't in English, for example. So I don't know if I can say right now, but certainly what comes immediately to mind is anybody involved with the ROER4D project in South Africa. I think Laura Chernovitz is leading that, and Sikana Waji comes to mind as well. And then, of course, I would want to think of a distance education pioneer as well. So somebody, I guess, like perhaps Alan Tate or Mark Bullen even. You've already got Tony Bates. There's also Erwin DeVries, who's recently retired, who's a Canadian. And then I wonder even, if it was possible to point to anybody who was involved in setting up Canada's French Open University, which is TELUC, which was, I think it was the first open university established in Canada. So, and that's a bit of a forgotten history as well. And it still exists today and is going strong. So,
now, Tanis, you are most definitely a legend of online learning. For someone like Tony Bates to talk about your work so highly, and clearly there's a very strong depth of practice, which you don't always see in distance and online education. For some people, distance education is something that's sort of completely separate to online. But I've always been impressed by the people who actually start with a distance education background, because I think it means you approach the technology in a very different way. You think more in terms of mediation, which I think is quite a useful useful perspective to have.
Yeah, that's actually a very good way of putting it. I would agree with that, actually. I think and the access piece tends to come out stronger. And I feel like you certainly notice that in the debates about open, the distance education open people versus the technology open people. For example, so we have very, overlapping but perhaps differently flavored conversations. So, and I think that's where some of the tension comes in, as we start to get critical about open, I think that's where the tensions are coming in.
Mm. Can you tell me a bit more about those tensions that you've experienced?
Well, I think there's tensions in how open is being currently defined versus people who maybe have experienced open in the open university education, distance education sense. And certainly, I think depending on where you're from, it's, you know, OER is, you know, considered a new sort of fresh open, I guess. But of course, I think it's much stronger when it's been informed by the past, and certainly what, you know, even open pedagogy has been discussed as something new. But of course, in my work, I found that open pedagogy was a very strong concept in French in the 1970s in Quebec and France. So
yeah.
Again, it comes back to, you know, what happens when you ignore history, or what happens when you limit your searches to English. And you can go down this path of, you know, conversations about open pedagogy, for example, without really being informed by what it meant 30, 40 years ago.
I remember in New Zealand, I was involved in distance and online education in the mid-2000s, and someone said to me once, I've just discovered this thing called instructional design. I think it's going to be very big. not really knowing that the literature there dates well back, decades before, with some quite major work. So it's definitely worthwhile being enriched by historical views and historical conversations.
Yeah, and maybe that's a journal that needs to happen. Maybe it's a journal that connects, you know, the historical with the current, you know, that ties that together for us. Maybe I would read that journal. And certainly the response seems to be, people seem to be very interested right now in talking about the history and resurrecting that. So I see that as a positive sign. So
Absolutely. Well, Tanis, it's been wonderful talking with you. You are certainly a legend of online learning. And it's been a real pleasure spending this half hour with you.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more about Tanis and her work from her blog at www.homonym.ca, and her Twitter handle is TanBob, both linked to from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website www.onlinelearninglegends.com to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.